Okay, so I was asked to pop this conference up and lead a panel discussion. So first I wanted to thank all the speakers, and in particular somebody who's not here but played a huge role in organizing this entire thing, so Dan Hooper. And let's thank Dan Hooper. So he's the guy who did most of the legwork for this conference. So really, thanks, Dan. I think he did a great job of mixing good topics and picking good speakers for these good topics. So I think I'm not going to do any summary talks for various reasons. In particular, because I think a summary talk is always a no-win proposition, in the sense that you don't mention somebody's talk, they get annoyed at you. You mention somebody's talk, you're doing it the wrong way. So, and in particular, of course, if you miss 70% of the talks, task becomes haunting. So instead, I think what I will do is to try to highlight myself and a few panelists what really I'm bringing home from this conference. And I think it's always important to keep in mind you know, the lesson learned from conferences. And so that's going to be what we call the summary talk. So I will ask this question. So what do you bring home to myself and to three panelists, so Gianfranco, Rafael, and Piero, and of course then to the audience. So what am I bringing home from this conference? I'm just going to mention two topics that are limited to the 30% talks I actually attended. So the first one is the issue or the fact that Tim talked about yesterday, that the CMSSM parameter space is compact, and I think I'm convinced of that. But I think there is an open question, which is, in detail, if you do a good job at calculating a Higgs mass, what is the largest mass that characterizes the CMSSM spectrum? And that's important because in this case, you would just have a set of three light particles, a lightest neutralino and almost degenerate neutralino and Chergino. And everything else is going to be very heavy. So how heavy? I think it's an interesting question. It has to do with how you calculate the Higgs mass. And David Sanford, Philip Kent, and others with me have discovered that there are interesting issues in that calculation, including you know, higher than two loop contributions to the Higgs mass. So it's an interesting game, and I'm very excited about jumping on that. And the second thing is, thanks to my advisor, PhD advisor, Piero Uglio. And he said something that struck my fancy, which is, OK, what would happen to the diffuse gamma ray emission if you extrapolate what we know about positrons locally? So there's something that injects high-energy positrons in the 10 to 100 GeV energy range. And presumably, we're not very special in a galaxy. So what happens if you extrapolate that positron population everywhere in a galaxy? Well, you will produce inverse Compton emission, and that's going to feed into our understanding of the diffuse gamma ray emission in the galaxy. That's an important question for dark matter searches. So I'm really excited about looking into that. Third thing I'm taking home is that the Gibraltar Road climb is very steep. And I apologize, Janice Gaskin, because I missed her talk yesterday. Because of my hubris, I thought I would go faster, but I didn't. So, this being said, I'm gonna pass the ball to let's see. Maybe Gianfranco, you wanna go first? Sure.
Well, first of all, I wanted to reassure a little bit Rafael on the dependence of all these you know, determinations of mass and cross sections on astrophysical quantities. I mean, it is true that for light WIMPs, this is a very delicate issue. But if, I mean, what you're seeing is correct. So if xenon sort of disfavors or rules out this region of low WIMPs, and if the WIMP is actually at, you know, something that resembles supersymmetry, like 50 GeV or above, I mean, that has an effect, and you know, probably using that like a parameterization, like Risa has just shown, it is important, at least at the level of marginalizing over uncertainties, but it's not going to change dramatically the conclusions you get from that. And the other quick comment I wanted to make, and then maybe I'll let the other Rafael and Piero say a few things. But the other thing I wanted to say is, since you brought this up, since you mentioned the CMSSM, I also wanted to mention that we should not obsess on the CMSSM. You know, everybody knows that this is basically a toy model that, you know, was constructed to study the phenomenology of supersymmetry. But we know that realistically, even if supersymmetry is there, I mean, there are good chances that it's quite different from a simplified version of the MSSM. So even if we rule it out, you know, with the next run of the LHC, there are many other regions of the parameter space that opens up. I mean, many phenomenology of supersymmetry, you know very well, is much more rich than what the CMSSM can offer.
Okay, so the question is, what am I bringing home? Mm-hmm. A lot of things, mainly two things. One is that, hey, like an astro kind of flavored conference, theory conference, is much better than one which comes from particle physics, because I actually can follow you guys' talks. So thank you very much. So that was really cool. And the other thing that blew me away really is that we spent, well, almost all of Wednesday in talking about being at the stage that we can learn something about the physics that are going on in the dark sector, self-interacting stuff, and we could be on the verge where we have measurements of that. I mean, that blew me away. I mean, think about it. Really, we are at that level that we can know what's going on in. We don't know what the dark sector is, but we have an idea that we might be seeing interactions in that sector. That was really, for me, one of the many things that blew me away. The other thing is, I'm actually not bringing anything home yet, because I'll also be here next week, so I'm looking forward to continue some of the discussions.
Yeah, we didn't coordinate, but since sounds like we did. Building up on what you just said, I don't know if this reflects the selection criteria of Dan Hooper or really the feeling of the community, but to me it's kind of very interesting that what is emerging from astrophysical and cosmological observation, that there are actually maybe an imprint in that on what we should learn from the particle physics, in the sense, is there really a new lamp scale connected to self-interaction or to free streaming that we can get out of there, and that we can use to learn about particle physics models, in the sense that the bothering point on the particle physics side, that when you attack the dark matter problem, is that you're really relying on prejudices. And the main prejudice, my starting prejudice is, okay, how do you put dark matter in the universe in the first place? What is the generation mechanism? And that is what has been leading us for 30 years searching for WIMPs, because we thought, oh, that's such a neat idea, and okay. But that's really a prejudice. Okay, you can have a prejudice for having dark matter as a condensate, and then you love the axiom idea, and so on. But it's really putting you on very narrow corners. They have a rich phenomenology, but they are narrow corners. And it would be really beautiful if we could learn something more from astrophysical and cosmological observation to patch the framework a little bit into physical questions.
Mm-hmm. Gianfranco, do you want to add anything, since you didn't really address that question?
No. Well, of course, you know, astrophysics is teaching us a lot. Well, first of all, I think it's quite remarkable that just using one type of collisionless particles, so that could be a WIMP or an axion or anything else, and just putting this into numerical simulations, is so successful at reproducing such a rich phenomenology at very large scales. So when we're talking about, you know, deviations from the CDM paradigm, we're really talking about, you know, very small scales where things like variants start to play a role. So one of the worries, of course, is that, you know, all this physics that, of course, you have this discrepancy between CDM and what you observe, and, you know, the obvious thing to do, this is what we were discussing over the coffee break, is you can absorb that physics into you know, the properties of the dark matter, and then you start playing with velocity dispersion of dark matter, warm dark matter type solutions, or self-interactions. Or you have the opposite a solution, which is, well, you trust that dark matter is perfectly cold and collisionless, you forget about any deviations from the paradigm, and you absorb all these uncertainties into baryonic physics. So I think one outstanding question, and this may be an obvious point where we can ask the feedback of the people in the audience, is whether there is any type of observation that can point directly to some type of dark matter physics, or for instance, self-interacting dark matter, that cannot be explained in terms of baryons. You have many knobs to turn in both sectors, right? So is there anything that would convince you that what you're saying is physics of dark matter and not baryons, or vice versa? I don't know if you guys want.
So yeah, Carlos touched on it earlier. We know the one thing that we know that dark matter does do is interact gravitationally. And so if you are, and this is a big if you are able to disentangle the lensing signal of a bunch of sort of galaxy scale lenses and be able to take from the observables the fact that there either is or is not a population of 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4 solar mass substructures that sort of fits lambda CDM type substructure mass functions that we don't see around the Milky Way, then, if that's not there, then you can say, okay, those satellites just don't exist, otherwise their gravity should be impacting the lensing observables. And that would tell you something about dark matter. Then, yeah, it's... Yeah, so that's a really hard problem. That deserves a talk or two. Right. So, but yeah, actually doing that lensing problem of extracting the substructure mass function parameters from lensing observables is hard and still not solved. So,
Theresa, do you
want? Well, I definitely agree with that. And certainly once you get down to substructures that are 10 to the 6, we don't expect them to have baryons. So that's definitely much cleaner. The other thing that I would say, I tend to be a little bit of a pessimist about this and always be in sort of it's baryons problem kind of thing, just because, not because I believe CDM has to be correct, just because I think that the uncertainties are currently large there. But, we heard from Allison today about, both how much uncertainty there still is, but also how much progress there's been. So I don't think we're going to solve this in the next, 2 years or anything, but at the same time, the constraints from surveys and on what galaxy formation has to be doing have gotten significantly stronger, and we can't just do anything with baryons. We actually have real constraints on what baryons are doing on large scales and on small scales. And those constraints are just now sort of starting to be applied to these kinds of simulations, now that both that we have those constraints and that we can do, actually start exploring parameter space, so that the uncertainties in the star formation feedback and, things can actually be constrained by data. So I think we have a long way to go before we'll be there, but I don't think we'll always have this sort of it could be baryons bucket.
Yeah, I think the key is to look for different probes that have different systematics. You're never going to get around the baryonic systematics. And so on Wednesday I mentioned merging galaxy clusters. And so these you still have baryons, you have the gas, but they're entirely different systematics than you see in, say, dwarfs and some of the problems that were discussed elsewhere. And so you're looking now for an offset between weak lensing signal, which is representative of your dark matter, and your galaxies, which now, instead of having to worry about all the different subprocesses of your galaxies, because you're talking about offsets which are about 100 kiloparsecs, so much larger than galaxy scale effects or in dwarf scale effects. So you're on completely different systematics, and now you can isolate different processes, and you should expect to see a consistent picture between the two, which is very nice.
Carlos. Turn on the mic, Carlos, if you can.
Yes.
Right. Is that better? So I just have a footnote to what Greg so eloquently just told us about the lensing. So I think the lensing is the way for STM because, as we know, below some mass scale, we're going to get 10 to the 10 mass, 90% of the halos are dark. Maybe a few times. So 90% of the halos are dark. So the universe is teeming with dark stuff. The only way to look at dark stuff is through lensing. Now, the and in particular, if we want to look at lensing in the Milky Way or Milky Way-like galaxies, then this flux anomaly that I was talking about is the way to go. And there are two parts to that problem. One is the theoretical part. And I mean, this was this goes back. So this was pointed out by Kochanek, Dalal and Kochanek about 10 years ago. And then Shudemao has worked on this. But the person who's really pioneering or moving forward this work is Dandan Shu. And she is the one who recognized for the first time that CDM seems to overproduce structure when you look just at one halo. And we now understand that that's to do with projection effects along the line of sight because lensing doesn't know, well, lensing is sensitive to everything that is along the line of sight. But that is something that we know how to calculate. So I think the theoretical side is pretty much just a matter of calculating. So it's not new. Thing is the observations. That is in a very, very primitive state. So it seems to me this is such an important problem. I haven't understood why the observers haven't really grabbed this and run with it. So yes, oh yes, sure. Right. So, you know, I know there are people doing it, but you need a very specific type of survey to do this. So I don't think DS is not going to do this problem. Pan-STARRS is not going to do it. Well, I know Pan-STARRS certainly is not going to do it. DS do other exciting things, but not this. So either new surveys of quasars, for example, or submillimeter galaxies, or maybe LSST, who knows what LSST would do. But I think that is a pressing problem of observational astronomy insofar as dark matter is concerned. And I think Jenny wanted the microphone, so here we
go. Okay, Pat.
I had another sort of footnote to add to that. I mean, there's a major, I guess, theoretical systematic that's ignored once you go down to low dark matter halo mass, and that's how much power there actually is in the primordial spectrum, because we don't really know that once you get down below about 10 to the 4 solar masses or so. So, I mean, there's a degeneracy there between...
No. 4 can easily be, you can get there with kinetic decoupling or non-thermal production.
Mm-hmm. No, not even from particle physics effects. I mean, from inflation, you don't know what the primordial power is by those sorts of scales. The only limits we have are from primordial black holes and ultra-thin halos. Yeah. So, I mean, but it's a theoretical systematic in as much as, like, it's an input for how you would work out what the concentration of these low-mass halos is. You don't know it below what's observed with ACT and SPT. You only have limits from primordial black holes, and you assume that it goes on in the same way, but you don't know that. There are lots of inflationary theories where it changes. Sorry? No, it depends on your theory of inflation or whatever's going on in the early universe. You can have a suppression of small-scale power, you can have a boost of small-scale power. And, I mean, the effect of this on population of the small-mass halos is going to be fairly degenerate with the nature of dark matter. So it's going to make it hard for you to distinguish warm from cold dark matter, even once you get counts in the lensing.
So maybe two more concluding remarks. Annika?
So one thing I'd like...
Yes.
Okay, so one thing I'd like to say about, like, the lensing is, so, I mean, I think there's still maybe in some parts of the community that, you know, if we measure something, you know, subhalos at 10 to 4 solar masses by light, that means, like, circle. But I would just like to point out, which Haibo was also pointing out, that just means that, you know, you have, like, power on those scales. So that means maybe something cold. So you could still have a very strong self-interaction and still get, like, 10 to the 4 solar mass subhalos in approximately the same abundance as you would for collisionless dark matter. So.
Go ahead, speak loudly.
Oh, so I just want to come back to the direct detection topic. I think I'm repeating Hybels' points, but I mean, people have been thinking that when you have a CDM dark matter halos, then when it's more equilibrium, you're getting more close to Maxwell Boltzmann distribution. But our preliminary results suggest that is not the case. So there's some mechanism that is keeping populating the high-speed high-speed particles in CDM case. But if the self-interaction dark matter particle could bring the distribution to a different, then in the future age where we have more real detection event from the direct detection experiment, we can actually using that information to come back to learn about the VDF and how that VDF constrain on the, I mean, property of dark matter itself. And I find that very interesting.
Okay. So switching gears, the second thing I wanted to bring up in this concluding talk is we've got a few tentative dark matter signals out there, and I wanted to propose a personal top four hit parade of this and then open up for discussion. So on number four in the hit parade, I put the positron axis. I think after the AMS data, that really doesn't smell like dark matter at all. It seems to be smelling a lot like an asteroid source, so it's really low on my list. Number three, I've got gamma ray galactic center access, and I think there are really a lot of systematic uncertainties on the feeding procedure and our understanding of what's going on in that environment. It's a very complicated problem. I think it's quite premature to associate whatever is there with dark matter. Number two, I put the CDMS events. I'm very excited about the events. Speaking with CDMS folks, they really take those things seriously. It is, of course, very worrisome that there's no consistency with xenon, and so that's why it's number two. Or number one, and I know this is going to be controversial, but I'm very, very excited still about the 130 or 135 GeV line. I don't think the line can be associated with any astrophysical source. We've looked into that with Christoph. And so if it is there, if it's confirmed, I think it's going to be a terrific result. It's going to tell us a lot. It's going to be a guideline for future searches for dark matter, for model building, etc. So this is my very personal top four hit parade, and I'm now opening the floor. Piero, you want to go ahead?
I think it is because since the tracking of the sun is around for at least 3 months or so, and you haven't seen a single paper in which with those mediators you are populating the sun, the 5 degrees around of the sun with enough winds, it doesn't work. I mean, I tried it out back on the envelope, it doesn't work, but maybe there are much more smarter people in the audience which can do it, but it's not the first thing you...
If you build a model such that Earth can capture dark matter and that it to produce a mediator, then the mediator travels through the Earth, then decay to two photons. Then you know what's the size of the ring, then you know the lifetime the mediator has to be. But the sun is much bigger. If you have one mediator, maybe it just stop inside the sun, cannot travel out. So you have to have two mediators at least to make it all.
even if it gets out of the sun, there's a direction which is out of the sun, which is along our line of sight to the sun. Mm-hmm. So you should still see them in the center of the sun, right? I mean, there's part of the atmosphere of the sun that is directly in the middle of the sun as we look, right? Mm-hmm. So if you don't see it in a 1 degree around the sun,
I just want to glue. Still putting it on top of the list is, for me, related to the fact that's the one with really the cleanest signature, and then I'm very keen about clean signature. Mm-hmm. So I really hope it's real.
Ah, well, that's a separate question. Well, if I had to address that question, I think there's two ways. One is wait and see what's going on with this past eight software tool. Basically it's a whole overhaul of the energy calibration of the instrument that it's ongoing in the collaboration. And so, hopefully it will erase a lot of the systematics that might be going on. And the second thing is using Cherenkov telescopes. So far, instruments that are around have a threshold that is just a little bit above 130 GeV, but perhaps with HES2, and especially with CTA, they're going to collect a lot of statistics very rapidly.
So HES2, when I first heard about this in Chicago last year, HES2 was going to rule it out of the perfect by treatment.
Yeah. I have a comment on that. We talked with Werner Hoffmann, who's the spokesperson of HES2.
Yes.
So it is true that they had first light in July 2012 for the HES2 telescope. But it, of course, as you know, when they say it takes like 100 hours to measure the line at 5 sigma, it means 100 hours after you have commissioned the instrument, you've understood the energy resolution, the energy threshold, and everything. Then you have 100 hours of clean data, and they're not there yet. So they're still working on, determinations of the study of the photons, especially of the showers. So they're not there yet.
Somebody say here that the background is so high that
the what?
The background.
No. I mean, we made an estimate based on the expected performance of the instrument, and they can see it 5 sigma. By Christmas. No, well, you need over the 50 hours of clean data. So with the galactic center very high on the horizon, with low zenith angle, Christoph is. Yeah, from March mm-hmm. to July. Probably, yeah. So this maybe you can comment on that.
He only mentioned that if the galactic center is very high, you're going to get 1,000 hours, various angles. And then it really depends on how you perform. We're not willing to make any statements in that direction.
Yes, so maybe your news. Information is newer than mine. So one point is that on statistical grounds, you can for sure see something after 50 hours. Purely on statistical grounds, if you assume their effective area and energy resolution, they should be able to see and confirm this line after 50 hours of observation. The crucial question will be whether they have the systematics under control, basically, because the backgrounds in Cherenkov telescopes are much higher, basically, than for Fermi, which is a zero background instrument after removing protons. And so the question is whether they can do this or not. And depending on to whom you talk, they are optimistic or not. Earliest, there might be results end of next year, so we have to wait. It just takes time. Yeah. To analyze the data, not necessarily to take the data.
I mean, background subtraction with those instruments is always on and off source, but of course, for a diffuse emission, that doesn't work. So it's not an easy game.
But it's in the regime where they come close to the threshold, so the effective mm-hmm. area will. I mean, it's close to the threshold, so can make things complicated.
Let's see.
But there's hope.
Team, did you want to comment on? Or Aaron? Okay.
I have.
Okay.
So one thing I think that you sort of left off the list, or maybe didn't characterize correctly, is the recent result from Hooper and Slatcher, where it's not just an excess in gamma rays at the galactic center, but extending to very high latitudes. And I think that a lot of criticisms or concerns that people have about systematics involved in extracting that don't necessarily apply when you're talking tens of degrees from the galactic center. So I just wanted to make the point in case someone wanted to comment.
So that's a very interesting result. Just two quick things. So if you look at the residual maps, as you go down towards the center, they look awfully clumpy, which might, you know, maybe, so now we're talking like 6 degrees away from the galactic center, 6 to 10 maybe, right? So they look awfully clumpy, and they maybe look more like some ISME kind of clouds. And so then you start saying, okay, well, what about the bump, right? Because it has a very bumpy shape. You know, the fits that they do to broken power laws for a proton spectrum, which gives you LCS, don't look so bad. But also, so when you can make a bump appear out of nothing, right? This is not an impossible task, right? So imagine, for example, that you underestimate the width of your inverse Compton, just your diffuse inverse Compton, right? So then the true inverse Compton is a little broader than what you estimate. So you subtract something narrower from something broader, and you can get a bump that way, right? So it's not impossible. And sort of all of these analyses are relying on templates for the diffuse emission, which are dependent on the radiation field, and our knowledge of the radiation field is pretty poor, especially as you get in towards the inner 5, 6, 7, 8 degrees of the galactic center. So it's very tricky. It's a very interesting, there's certainly something there. I totally agree with them that there's something there. But whether it quacks like dark matter, I'm not exactly sure. At 20 and 30 degrees, well, again, it depends. Well, for the spectral feature, yes. So by eye, you can't really, it's hard to actually see anything there, right? But for the spectral feature, yes. If your template is dependent on spectra of photons or spectra of electrons or cosmic rays that you don't know, then it gets really tricky.
So I have a comment that might make me extremely unpopular, but since I'm used to it. So it's sort of a question to the panelists and probably to everybody. The fact that all your points, they seem to be inconsistent with each other within the CDMS, doesn't it probably, or okay, with the caveat that if you can do some theoretical virtuosisms, doesn't probably highlight more our willingness to see something rather, that's exactly the question. So the fact that there seem to be sort of pointing toward different directions, doesn't make you feel uncomfortable, or?
No, it just takes one valid one, you know? but it's not. And do you really have just 1 degree of freedom? Uh-huh.
So personally, and yes, this is going to be a curmudgeonly comment, I don't believe any of it. I mean, I think basically what this points out is just how hard this business is. You know, who knew that like pulsars were going to be such a huge pain in the butt for you know, doing anything with gamma rays, and magnetic fields are disgustingly gross. The interstellar radiation field is also gross. Doing things near threshold is really gross. So I think what I've learned from all of this is just how hard our task is.
Me?
So curmudgeonliness, and I also think they're all wrong. But I want to make it a little bit more optimistic. I mean, I think it's likely that they're all wrong, but it's also tremendously exciting. And actually, the fact that pulsars can be confused with dark matter is kind of cool, and it might mean that we'll be motivated to learn more about pulsars and, you know, all of the other astrophysics that is messing this all up. So, I mean, I don't know. I think the next 5 years are going to be very confusing, and there's going to be a lot of more fake signals, and we should be very skeptical of all of them. But at the end of the day, it's just showing us how rich the observations are and how particle physicists and astrophysicists have to talk to each other and maybe learn broader science, and I think that's very exciting.
So. I wouldn't characterize these as wrong necessarily, right? Because they probably don't have to do with dark matter, but that doesn't mean that they're wrong.
That's all I meant.
Okay.
I want to say that even though, you know, I personally agree, I tend to think they're probably all wrong. I mean, I think there's still reason.
Well, so wrong, you mean that there's rising positron fraction, or that the positron fraction doesn't have to do
wrong
with dark matter?
Sorry, I don't think they're
okay.
Dark matter.
Good.
Probably not. But I think there's still reason to be optimistic because, personally, in all likelihood, I think we're going to get some kind of hint from the next phase of the LHC, and that should be able to drive us, you know, towards testing.
So yeah, I mean, just to expand on Stefano's comment, I mean, the 130 GeV line could be real. It could be real at the galactic center and the Earth limb and the sun, but it's some other kind of new physics that happens in high density photon field environments that we just don't know, right? So it doesn't necessarily have to be dark matter. It doesn't necessarily have to be wrong either. Just throwing that out there.
Can I?
Okay,
yeah, there you go.
Yeah, to just expand on something that Risa said, the thing that I took away most of all from this conference was the complementarity of all of these different methods. And I learned in so many different ways how things which I thought were completely disconnected now could provide insight. And you're really developing a sense of cross-check. So we don't know which of these, but we know that there's a lot more correlation between all of our different approaches than I think we first took it at onset. And so, for example, I mean, I was talking with Hai Bo about self-interacting dark matter, and if you see it on three different scales, that constrains your parameter space extremely tightly. And these are all different. They all different scales have different systematics, and so you're getting at this from that. And then, as Risa's talk highlighted this morning, depending on what type of physics and also baryonic physics, your dark matter properties, that will have direct implications for what you expect to see in CDMS or xenon. And if, as we start to build up statistics, that gives us some powerful constraint on what the dark matter properties are.
Right. All right, but we can only do that for place number one, so for the top of the heat parade. So cannot collect in real time ranking of the four. We can do that. So who's in favor of putting on top the positron axis?
Okay. Believing in one, who believes in the dark matter interpretation?
Well, believe is a big word, but so why don't you phrase what you want?
Yeah, that's really strong. How about some possibility that this is a dark matter signal?
Right.
Okay, so let's.
No, I like Patty's suggestion.
What's my suggestion? Oh, you can use a clapometer. We can take the volume as a measure of confidence. Good question. We can do it both ways. That'll be our prior.
Okay, so raise your hand if you think that the positron excess might be due to dark matter. That's one. Greater than 50%. 50%. Okay. How about the gamma ray galactic center excess? At least 50. Hey, at least, I hope at least Tim would, okay. Okay, so let's say six, seven people. How about CDMS silicon events? Okay, well, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, okay. How about the 130 GeV line? Okay, since... Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 7.5, 8. Okay, so... Yeah.
So it looks like the CDMS...
CDMS
would
be
on
the top of the list.
You're not going to see that. I think we got
Stefano,
only 5 minutes.
Stefano, may I make just one quick point?
Oh, yeah.
I just realized that when you put it up, actually, what I find fascinating about that is that you can, in all earnesty, discuss each and every one of those signals as actually being due to dark matter, which just tells us how extremely sensitive we've become. Hey, great, fantastic. Mm-hmm. But as you put them all up, I started to realize, wow, I always thought there was this nice connection between, you know, CDMS and all that stuff and the galactic, like Dan Hooper's story, right, at all. And I thought that's a really nice point to make in favor of that explanation of dark matter. But actually, then you added the 130 GeV line and the positron excess and go like, what? And I realized we have to be very careful when we say, what does it take to convince us of dark matter? And we say what it takes us is to have different probes pointing to the same thing. In the limit where we have many, many, many probes that all come up with something, you are just, I mean, there's a trial factor. You're just bound to have something which agrees with each other.
Okay, so the last thing that I wanted to bring up is that in 2 weeks, there's going to be a conference here called Snowmass on the Pacific. And the Snowmass process, for those of you who are not familiar with it, is a community study of high energy physics in the United States that wishes to do the good that the Cato survey has done and is doing to the field of astronomy and astrophysics. And so, we're getting together and trying to understand what we're excited about in our field and how the next decade could make the field even more exciting, what experiments that are most crucial are, et cetera, et cetera. And as part of the SNOMAS process, there's a set of big questions. And so some of these big questions are relevant to dark matter, and I don't think we have time to go through them, but I'd just like to flash them. So there's a couple of questions that are directly relevant for direct detection, so maybe I'll ask Raphael to briefly comment on them. The first one is about, there's this beautiful variety of initiatives in searching for dark matter via scattering, elastic scattering of dark matter off of nuclei, but at some point you need a criterion by which you need to abandon small initiatives in favor of bigger ones, and where should the line be set is an important question. And the second one is kind of along similar lines, is, you know, suppose experiments using one target are much, much better than those using any other target. Is there a reason to pursue different targets and to invest money doing that? So Raphael.
But I'm only answering those because you forced me to. First question, when is the right time to abandon small projects? So let's just get the scale right. The Xenon 100 experiment, currently leading experiment by an order of magnitude, total capital cost of that experiment, everybody venture a guess? $1.5 million, okay? You can do that on two startups, the whole Xenon 100 experiment capital cost. It is ridiculous to abandon any of those experiments for monetary reasons. They are so cheap. Mm-hmm. Their scientific reach, we're talking about orders of magnitude, cutting orders of magnitude in the relevant parameter range. Complementary to what is happening at the LHC, where you have any ATLAS collaboration meeting costs more than the Xenon 1-ton detector, probably, right? I mean, it's just ridiculous to even discuss abandoning experiments in this field, where frankly, we have no clue what dark matter is about, and that's what all this conference was about. And you're talking about one of those really complementary areas where you have even complementary techniques. You don't have only accelerators where you only have one proton-proton collider, but you have all these different targets, you have all those different sensitivities to background, to signals. And seriously, you're cutting about, you're talking about cutting in that field. So that answers the first question.
Good.
And the second one, I just refuse for the same reason to answer. It's just ridiculous that we're even discussing that at this really small amount of money that we're putting in. I think we're doing us ourselves no favor at all in arguing against each other in the dark matter community why one direct dark matter search experiment is better or worse than the others. I think the discussions that we're having should tell us enough that they are really worth their money and we should pursue simply all of them.
Absolutely. So thank you very much, Rafael. You won't be here for this NOMAS and the Pacific Conference, will you? Right. Okay, good. Correct. Yeah, that's right. Oh, I don't know. That's just the way the question was phrased. So these questions were actually written in stone and circulated to the entire SNOMAS process, so they peaked spin independent.
So I don't know if this is going to be in your questions 3 through 5, but I want to second Raphael's comment and think, say that, you know, I think everything we're learning shows the power of having more than one, you know, kind of experiment with more than one target. But I also want to speak in favor of next generation indirect detection, because I think, you know, we've seen it, I think it's a little discouraging, you know, in the sense that, oh, good. Okay.
Especially number 4. So, you know, what future experiments are needed in you know, cosmic rays?
Yeah, I guess I want to encourage everyone in this room to try to speak in favor of this, because I think these experiments are really at risk for funding in the U.S. And I think, you know, it's just, you know, it's not clear that we will actually, that dark matter is going to be convenient enough that we will see it in at the LHC and in indirect and direct. It may not be that, something that's actually doable, at least in this decade, but we certainly should try. So.
We have 5 more minutes.
Right.
Do you want to show question number 5?
Sure. So question number 5 is kind of the wrap up. Big million-dollar question. So what would it take to convince ourselves that we have a discovery of dark matter, 2 different dark matter species, that we discovered all of the dark matter, and that we have instead a full signal? So I think this is it's a very hard question to be asked in general.
I think I just wanted
maybe
to
you
bring,
have thoughts.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up something that can be done to be reasonably convinced that you discovered all or most of the dark matter. And that uses the complementarity between what you observe in accelerators and what you observe in direct detection, for instance. So suppose that you discover something that resembles supersymmetry at the LHC, and the game you want to play at that point is to try to reconstruct the relic density of the particle. Now, unless you're really in the CMSSM, so a very constrained model, and you want to analyze the data into a more general framework, that's going to be quite challenging. Typically, what you find is that there will be solutions of your, if you just reconstruct the properties, you will find that part of your posterior distribution will be consistent with the total dark matter, so omega squared over the 0.1. But it's very probable, actually, that you will not get, you know, this very precise, narrow delta function reconstruction of that. And if you bring in the constraints from direct detection under reasonable assumptions, then you can nail this down with a pretty good accuracy, actually, which is, you know, not so far, not so distant in terms of precision from what you get, from the determination you get of omega squared from cosmological measurements. So that's kind of encouraging. But that's a model-dependent statement.
Right, so this is kind of what Ted Baltz had done a few years ago before making big bucks at Google.
They didn't explore the complementarity there. They explored the reach of the LHC and the ILC.
Well, they, re- I think he showed how well you could reconstruct the relic density after direct detection and colliders.
Yeah, so what I'm suggesting is that if you take that and you combine this with the red detection under some assumptions,
right,
then you can break the degeneracy in the parameters.
Of course, the problem is that the LHC has been running, and it hasn't seen anything. And if it will see anything, it will be very marginal and probably not very helpful to really reconstruct anything about the dark matter
problem. No, not necessarily. I mean, we've studied this in a quantitative way. And since you're going up in the center of mass energy, it is true that unless you discover it quite soon, within 1 or 2 years, then it's unlikely that you can, I mean, your improvement in that direction will become kind of marginal. But I see we probably need to stop, right, Jesse?
Yeah.
Okay, so maybe you want to wrap this up, Stefano?
Well, I guess I'm going to just thank all the speakers at the conference, and thanks for everyone for coming.
We can start with thank you guys. There's one with Henry Grohl, you can talk to that microphone. So yeah, I'd just like to thank the Italian market here. Stefano and Franco here, and Greg.
By the way, Roberto is Swiss, he's not Italian.
But anyway, thank you very much for organizing such a wonderful conference.
Thank you.